It was the great American civil rights activist Martin Luther King Jr. who said, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice." And what a bumpy arc that's been recently, especially for those in America. Trump, Obama, the rise of the Tea Party, the financial crash, Hurricane Katrina, Bush and the Iraq War, the war in Afghanistan. It feels like we've lived a lifetime in just a couple of decades. But our guest this week, Professor Gary Young, has been in the thick of the action as the former US correspondent for The Guardian. While there, he published four books, earning himself a place as the Orwell Prize finalist for Another Day in the Death of America, where he chronicled the death of 10 young lives to gun violence in a 24-hour period. Since his return to the UK, he's taken up a role as Professor of Sociology at the University of Manchester. And academia now goes hand in hand with his reporting. It's clear that identity politics, is very much at the core of his thinking.
People who've known you, who've employed you for 25 years, say, if you don't have this piece of paper, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to go. And that suddenly you can lose everything. When you say, OK, I'm going to look at white America, people are like, well, what, you know, what? Aren't we doing that all the time? And it's like, well, no, we don't specifically. There are major achievements that have been made in terms of race, and those have to be celebrated.
That's Gary Young, talking about identity and America with me, Will Hutton, for the We Society. Hello. This week I'm speaking to Professor Gary Young, fellow of the Academy of Social Sciences, an award-winning journalist with The Guardian, who recently leapt over to academia to become a professor of sociology at the University of Manchester. Gary uniquely blends the social sciences with reporting, and despite his new role, is still winning awards for his writing. Recently shortlisted for the Orwell Prize for Journalism in 2021 for his searing analysis on COVID's devastating impact on Britain's minority communities. Long before Donald Trump set his sights on the White House, Gary was exploring and warning of the dangers of a politics framed solely by identity politics. His confrontations with some far-right hate figures have become the stuff of legend. He adeptly chairs academic conferences between his well-researched books, and he brings luster to sociology. Gary, welcome to the We Society podcast.
Thanks for having me, Will.
And I'm going to open up this kind of conversation. Kind of, you know, when I contacted you and said, would you, you know, join the We Society podcast, and you heard this We Society phrase, what was your first thoughts?
I assumed it must stand for something, like WE somehow, kind of, you know, work equality or so. I didn't know that it would necessarily mean we, as in first-person plural. But now I do. Well, in so many ways, the issue of we is one of the fundamental questions of our time, I think. Who we count as being among us, who we count as being part of us, who we consider ourselves part of, that in all sorts of ways that is, for better and for worse, framing our politics.
And I mean, you were first into this. I mean, from the outset of your journalism, it's been a feature. You're a black man. Did that kind of mean that you kind of were more alert to this notion, do you think?
I think that growing up black in Britain in the 70s, when I did, forced a reckoning with who you were. People would say, you know, well, you're not from here. Go back to where you came from. Or even at university, I remember humorously, although the man wasn't being humorous, he said, Mr. Young, where are you from? And I said, Stevenage. And he said, well, where were you born? And I said, well, Hitchin. And he said, well, before then. And I said, well, there was no before then. You know, that's where this is where I'm from. And so you, when you are othered, you are kind of, you are forced to have some understanding of where you are in relation to others. You know, nobody's ever asked me, when did you realize you were straight? Because it's not a question that is asked of a straight person. Or how did you balance being a foreign correspondent in America with children? Having children, because nobody asks a man that question. So the more powerful your identity is, the less likely you are to even have to think of it as an identity at all. So growing up black when I did, Yeah, it forced a kind of, or it offered a critical eye on what I could see. Because also it meant that people were saying things about me, sometimes to me, that I knew weren't true, you know, and I'd be thinking, well, why do you think that? Why are you saying that? Where is that kind of coming? Where is that coming from? And navigating that was actually kind of part of your, if not survival, then certainly your capacity to thrive meant trying to figure out who people actually thought you were. You know, when you walk into a room and somebody thinks, well, here comes somebody who's going to pick my pocket, or here comes a brilliant dancer, or here comes a, you know, here comes a, you know, super cool dude, all of which would be wrong, by the way.
Well, you're fairly cool.
So,
Then about your dancing.
So, yeah, I think that kind of, I think that's often the case.
We call this series the We Society because, you know, social science, and you are a social scientist, you're a sociologist now. In a sense, you know, what social scientists do is to kind of look at economic and social structures and see how they kind of interface with kind of systematic behaviours, patterns of behaviour, sense of oneself, and how it sort of translates into action in institutions. I mean, it's a dynamic study from across the piece, I mean, from economics to through sociology, through politics. But having called it the We Society, you're then left with the question, well, there are good We's and bad We's. I mean, Vladimir Putin would say, you know, I'm waging my war in the Ukraine because I'm asserting the we-ness of Russia.
Yeah.
We'd want to assert that the kind of communitarian we that we want to kind of bring to life, more mortal life in Britain, is going to be kind of outward-facing and progressive and inclusive. But there are other we's. I mean, there's the we of some of the hate right-wing figures, mm-hmm. white figures, white supremacists that you've confronted. Now, how do you make sense of... I mean, all of that's identity politics.
Yep.
How do you make sense of all of that? I mean, where's it coming from? Why is that? Why is it? Why is there so much of it about now?
I mean, the first thing I would say, and this was the kind of core of my book, Who Are We?, which is kind of very apt given the We Society, was identity is an essential, as in important, place to start, because we all have one. We all have many, in fact. And to ignore, well, you know, I'm coming at this from a, you know, a British man of a certain age, and you know, so on, it would be a problem. But it's a terrible place to finish. It's the kind of identity is like the gas that you put in your car. Then you've got to get on the road with everybody else. And so the kind of the identity that the we that I embrace is a we of values, not of essential characteristics of race or nation or gender or religion. It's a we of values and a we when growing up black in Britain with my parents being from Barbados, there was this thing. It's a very standard child of immigrant thing, where you think, well, I'm not really British. I don't really come from here. People keep telling me I'm not from here. My mother says, well, we're Barbadian and so on. We've got a picture of Barbados on the wall. And then you go to Barbados and they say, well, you're not from here, obviously. You know, you're from somewhere else. And sooner or later, not everybody does this, but I kind of thought, right, okay, where's my home? Well, my home is where my people are. And my people are the people who like to laugh and who care about other people. My people are a people of kind of values and of the kind of behaviours that I can get behind, and I can find those people anywhere in the world. And then there is another we, the we that you just referred to, which is a we that says we are better than them. We as opposed to them. We as the end point, not as the beginning point, but as the end point, that we Russians, we black people, we Hutus, we Americans, and we as opposed to others, as opposed to us among others, and that us being about values as opposed to something essential.
And that gives as soon as you kind of develop we as in opposition to or against or superior to, you know, other communities, it kind of unleashes, I mean, most terrible kind of things. I mean, it justifies hate, it justifies killing, it justifies...
Genocide.
I mean, it's...
In fact, you need it for the genocide to happen. You need to think, actually, beyond anything else, we are human and they are not. That's how genocide happens. They do not deserve life. I mean, it's the logical end to a certain kind of politics of identity.
As a sociologist, I know now you have kind of the time to kind of really read and explore. I mean, who do you think, you know, within the kind of canon of sociology has the best handle on this?
I think, honestly, I think different elements within sociology, no one has it all. I would emphasize. I think Zygmunt Bauman was excellent. I think Paul Gilroy is brilliant in terms of, you know, Paul kind of teases out the issue of camps, that, you know, standing between camps, kind of arguing against race thinking as a kind of as a way of understanding the world, which people kind of, you know, do fall into. There's been Benedict Anderson on imagined communities and kind of nationalism. I mean, there is, I think Edward Said was brilliant.
Yep.
There's been a range of, you know, really, really strong work that I admire.
When you're, I made reference when I introduced you to your kind of these legendary confrontation you had with kind of some right-wing hate figures in the States. It takes some bravery to seek them out, because it's going to make good television, of course, if you get it right. Mm. But when you kind of engage in argument with these people, I mean, what are you thinking? I mean, where do you think, how do you think they've got to where they've got to, and what's the best riposte to it?
I mean, interestingly, because the most infamous one was with Richard Spencer in Tennessee, who was part of the kind of claimed the leader of the alt-right, which was kind of like fascist, really. And the reason, first of all, you have to have a good reason to kind of put them on camera at all, I think. Titillation is not good enough, and actually, quite often, that's what the TV people want. But the context for talking to him was that we were doing a program about white America, not about racist America, about white America. The fact that white American mortality rates, they're falling, like life expectancy.
Yeah, life expectancy.
Falling.
It's a crisis.
Yeah, the opioid crisis.
Indeed, the most recent work is that actually the kind of life expectancy of poor whites in especially the southern states is now no better than Hispanics. It's becoming a kind of, it's about income and life experience as much as race, actually.
Yeah, and what do they call it? The deaths of despair.
Yeah.
Suicide, alcoholism.
Yeah.
And that... And the premise for this was I've seen Black America, you know, examined many times. But when you say, okay, I'm going to look at white America, people are like, well, what, you know, what, aren't we doing that all the time? And it's like, well, no, we don't specifically look and see how white people are doing. And actually, there's a significant section of America that aren't, they're not doing very well. Most people who are shot dead by police are white, actually. I mean, proportionally, Black people are way more likely to be shot, but most people who are shot dead by the police are white. And the issue of who is speaking up for those people, where do those people find community and resistance? Where do they work to improve their lot? Is a very kind of important one. And so we were going around America talking to people who'd struggle with drug addiction. We went to a kind of Johnstown, Pennsylvania, which a former mill town, completely crushed by outsourcing, globalization, all that kind of stuff. Many of whom are Trump supporters, but not all. And so Richard Spencer sat within that kind of within that group, because not because they shared his views, because none of them did, but because he was trying to feed off their discontent, and was actually doing quite well. And so I felt it was important to speak to someone who was doing that, and to say, well, you know, my first question to him was, and it soon went off the rails after that, you say you want a white ethno state. What is that? And then, you know, it kind of, you know, it got crazier after that. But that these people emerge from the ashes, and there is a desperation. And every now and then you get a populist. Jesse Jackson did very well in the 80s. You know, when the lights go out and the factories closed, we're all the same color in the dark. You know, managing to kind of create a community in class and economic suffering that transcended the differences of race and region and so on. So that was the basis on which I went to see.
Yeah, yeah. But a white ethno state, of course, is not. I mean, manufacturing jobs. High-wage manufacturing jobs. I mean, they're kind of colorblind. I mean, they have their roots in very profound things and not in race. I mean, the guy can't see that at all.
Well, that's not his shtick. It's not. He's interested in he derives his currency.
Yeah.
From peddling a certain kind of wear, and that wear, those wares are, look at these jobs. They're going to China, they're going to India, these people are coming across the border and they're taking your stuff. Affirmative action, they're taking your stuff. The reason why you are poor and suffering is because they are taking your stuff. It used to be better for you.
Yeah.
You used to have a better life. Your father, and they usually do, your father had a better life than you. Do you think your children are going to have a better life than you? Fight for... White people had it good in this country and now they don't. You need to fight for what you had. And that has an appeal, you know. And I guess one of the things that I wanted to do with the documentary was kind of was lift the hood up and see where that appeal came from.
Talking to Hillary Clinton in the same podcast series as you're in. I mean, her view was this fundamentalism and this polarization of American society got a lot to do with misinformation, screen time, the ability of right-wing media figures to manipulate opinion and views, and of course inequality was part of the story. But she was, she laid the blame squarely there and not at kind of systematic economic disadvantage.
Yeah, and I think some of that blame can be laid there. But, I mean, if you look at America as a country...
Which you know well. I mean, you crisscrossed America, you've travelled it, you've
reported
it.
Yeah, I lived there for 12 years.
Exactly,
yeah.
I mean, you did it.
I think that... If you've been a slave state for 200 years...
And it is the original sin, isn't it?
Yeah, and then you've been an apartheid state for 100 years, and you've only been a non-racial democracy for... 54 was Brown versus Board of Education, 64 was the Voting Rights Act. So we're talking 60 years that it's been a non-racial democracy. I mean, I don't think... And white people are in a majority there, but if you look at South Africa, I think in 2050-something, that would be 60 years after the first elections, there are still going to be significant racial problems. So I think that these kind of these views come from somewhere quite that are rooted in the kind of in the country, and that the kind of the misinformation, which is legion, if you think of January the 6th and the hearings that are taking place right now about kind of about what happened.
The January 6th hearings, yeah.
And the number of people who still deny that Biden won, who are being elected. There were just elections in Nevada. And the slate of people who think that the election was stolen is still huge. And you see in the hearings, they unpick the level of denial where Trump says, show me the proof. And they said, there is no proof. And they say, he just didn't listen. He just went to the next person and showed me the proof. Then there is a willfulness about this misinformation. It can't be a coincidence that the people who embrace this misinformation or, you know, happen to be of a similar demographic type, they tend to kind of concentrate in certain areas of the country, that there is a profile of who is most likely to be misinformed, which suggests that they are looking for the information that they want.
Yeah.
But the basis on which they want it, I think, is rooted in real material things. I think it's true that for a lot of people, if they look back two generations, the benefits of being white and male were greater. They had more rights. They had more power. And now they have less power as white people, and they have less power as men, and that hasn't really been replaced by anything. They've also lost their industries, they've lost their jobs, and they put those two things together and they say, you took my life. It's a very, very desperate kind of very desperate state of affairs.
I just want quickly to pause the conversation here to tell you a bit about the Academy of Social Sciences, the organisation behind the We Society podcast. Formed in 1982, the Academy of Social Sciences is a home for academics, practitioners, and learned societies in the social sciences. Imagine a world which is more equal, more sustainable, and politically stable. Well, the social sciences are trying to achieve just that. The social sciences aren't just about theories for academics in ivory towers. Those in the field strive for concrete and positive change in society, often for the most disadvantaged. We want to solve big issues around the climate crisis, poverty, education, health inequalities. The list goes on, as the breadth of what social scientists strive to achieve is almost limitless. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences work and support us by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. And don't forget to follow the We Society on Twitter at the We Society Pod. Now, back to the conversation. Donald Trump's return is not impossible. And then that begs all kinds of questions about, you know, the US's place in the world, what's going to happen to the West, what's going to happen to its, you know, what's going to happen to NATO, what's going to happen to our security here in Britain. I mean, it's a big deal what's happening. I mean, should we have done globalization more slowly? I mean, in retrospect, we are where we are. Should the parties, the progressive parties in America, done a better job of actually identifying and selling the values that you think are the way you can trump all this, to coin a phrase?
I think that there is a well, a few things. I do think that the way that globalization has gone has created a kind of level of inequality globally that is forcing people to move. If you add climate change to that, it's kind of, you know, the forces that are pushing people who probably don't even want to move to kind of, to, you know, to find new lives. And so that sense of feeling under assault, that the West has of kind of, you know, building the fortress even higher, of stopping these hordes from, you know, coming him. There is a sense of siege in the West that I do think is related to the way that globalization has progressed. I was reminded of this with the issue of the flights to Rwanda, flying refugees to Rwanda, and Keir Starmer, spokesman, refusing to say that Labour opposed it in principle. And the logic behind this was that, well, this is a wedge issue and they want to lead us in this wedge issue. And I felt that, look, at some stage, you have to make a stand about what's right and decent and what's not, about what's moral and what's not, about what's humane and what's not. And that if you don't, then what happens is it keeps... the Overton window gets bigger or smaller, however you understand the Overton window. You have to push back on this stuff.
In fairness, Yvette Cooper, the Shadow Home Secretary, you know, did come in very strongly in the House of Commons on this, actually.
She did, but her thing was that this was badly organised. This was a gimmick.
Not attacking it in terms of values.
In terms of principle, and that it was inhumane and so on. And I do understand the politics behind that, but I also feel that I know, and Brexit was a very good example of this, that will come back and bite you in the bum at a certain point. That the conversations that we didn't have about immigration for years and years because it was considered problematic, they came to visit us. And one of the remarkable things I found, watching the news, the 10 o'clock news, and you had the issue of the refugees, then you had the issue of the cost of living crisis, then the strikes, and then the issue of kind of a shortage of labour and of trying to find people to work. And I was just thinking, these things are clearly related. They are clearly related. And I wonder what the logic is in a moment where we have a crisis of labour, where large numbers, where we have seen that we need immigrants to work.
Do you think in 2022 that life's got easier for black people in Britain?
I would say no. The reason being that it's got harder for everybody, right? Cost of living crisis and so on. And I think that the way in which it gets harder for everybody, because black people tend to be poorer, and that's a consequence of who our parents were, and, you know, children of bus drivers do less well than children of bankers, you know, and my parents in my generation were more likely to be bus drivers and nurses. So there is a kind of generational reason why, broadly speaking, people from the Caribbean, particularly Bangladeshi, Pakistani, do worse. Indian, African, slightly better, considerably better, some of them. So when things get bad for everybody, they get considerably worse for black people. There is what Paul Gilroy calls a conviviality, which grows. We feel better, generally speaking, as a society about ourselves. We are more comfortable in our personal relationships. Mixed race relationships in Britain are higher than anywhere else in Europe, and certainly higher than in America as a kind of proportion of our population. That in a range of ways, we feel better. But then when you look at the stats, we're not doing better. And there was a, YouGov did a survey just after Black Lives Matter, and the proportion of people who thought that things were still pretty bad racially who were black was almost the same as people who, as I think 30 years ago, I think. Now, some of that is about kind of goalpost shifting.
I mean, it's impressive, however, if you take the Premier League, the way they continue, the players continue to take the knee. Mm. And actually, of course, there's, you know, we know there's racism in football, but I'm, you know, I go along to the watch the Arsenal. I'm really quite, you know, I mean, the Arsenal crowds are kind of devoted to their black stars. I mean, there's no sense, you know, they're bloody good footballers and they'd love to have them, you know. And there's this kind of, and I do think that's a bit better than it was. I mean, but there's a lot of other damn crap stuff going on, I know. But I sometimes feel good about the way the Arsenal crowd reacted to the black team, or largely, you know, the black stars.
I honestly think that, there's a range of ways in which I've emphasised in my work and in this podcast, ways in which things are troubling and are bad. They're not uniformly bad, and they're not uniquely bad. There are things about this country that are brilliant in terms of race, and there are major achievements that have been made in terms of race, and those have to be celebrated. Otherwise, there's this sense that we're never going anywhere. But what we can't do, a la Sewell, is take those success stories and say, so that actually negates all the other stuff. So in America, when people used to ask me, African Americans in particular, where would you rather be black? And I would say, well, in England, I was the son of a single mum, three boys. Statistically, in America, one of us would have ended up dead or in jail, statistically. That's not true in Britain. I had a hernia when I was 8. It was fixed by the NHS. It didn't bankrupt my family. My mother was a nocturnal epileptic. She got the meds. She worked. Didn't bankrupt the family. When I got the grades, I could go to university. I went to the university of my choice. When my mother died when I was 19, I was given more money to stay at university. In a range of ways, not because of race, but because of class, actually. All of those things that I got were because we were working class, or because we were British and therefore we have an NHS. All of those things were possible in Britain in a way in which they weren't in America. Some of them are no longer possible, actually, but they were when I was growing up. But then you get to a point in Britain where it doesn't really know what to do with you. You come out of university, and that next step is actually very, very hard. Yeah. And whereas in America, if you get through, then then all bets are off.
Yeah, you can really earn it.
Which is why you see so many talented Britons, black Britons. This is particularly true in the acting world, but not uniquely. End up in America, because they get to a certain point, and then Britain becomes very difficult. But there is another thing, which is just it would be negligent to miss, which was the Windrush scandal, because the Windrush scandal sent a chill through all of us. One of my cousins was caught up in it, but it sent a chill through all of us because it gave a clear indication of how contingent our presence here might be. How at some point you might have to prove where you've been for the last 30 years, that the people who've known you, who've employed you for 25 years, say, if you don't have this piece of paper, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to go, and that suddenly you can lose everything. And that was incredibly chilling.
Now, you've made this jump from journalism to academia. You know, what prompted that? I mean, it's not a usual thing to do.
I'd had one foot in and one foot out before. So I was a visiting professor at Brooklyn College for a couple of years when I was in America. I'd done some adjunct teaching at NYU. part of the macabre explanation is, I'd been at The Guardian for 26 years, and I had a conversation with myself. Do I want to die here? You know, I'm 50. Maybe I want to do something else. But I was prompted by, I don't see it, obviously it's a shift in career. I don't see it as a complete shift in trajectory, because I'm still interested in the same things. I still want to find things out. I'm still curious. I feel like I have more time to indulge my curiosity and more space, whether that is, you know, because you have a column and you've been an editor and the kind of, you know, I want 1,000 words by, you know, by 4 o'clock. Whereas in academia, it's like, I want 7,000 words by April, you know, by the end of April. And so you have time, you know, they'll say, colleagues will say, we're not looking for anything long. 8,000 or 9,000 words will be fine, you know, which kind of is bigger than anything you would get in a newspaper, which of course could mean that you pad it out with a load of flab, or it could mean that you really get to kind of go that extra mile.
There's the other question of who reads it, of course. A 1,000-word piece gets read by a lot of people. 9,000 words, you know, much less. I mean, I need to say, do you think? I mean, what's the next big project? What's the next thing you've got on your eye? What have you got your eye on? And how does it mesh with being a social scientist?
So I am working on a book about Black Europe, Black post-war Europe, and the idea is to kind of a little bit like white America, where I reposition the gaze and say, well, let's look at it like this. And that kind of to reposition the gaze and say, well, let's look at black people as being the center of Europe and not in the periphery of Europe, as the people who were actually kind of, you know, quite, if you take the colonies, actually absolutely fundamental in the war effort, and then were kind of were very important in the rebuilding of large sections of Europe, and then came the crisis, and then have actually become central to a series of anxieties around European politics, and are absolutely kind of fundamental to European culture. You talk about that kind of Arsenal football team, that of the European nations who have football teams, more than two-thirds of them have had black players, including the Faroe Islands, Iceland, Northern Macedonia. You know, in 1999, there were just 3 weeks where a black European wasn't number one somewhere in Europe. If we look at our bookshelves, if we listen to, you know, what's going on in the radio, if we watch sport, that actually most of Europe would be impossible to imagine without black people at this stage. And so culturally, unfortunately, if we look at our boardrooms and parliaments, it'd be all too easy to imagine. But and so to look at a range of ways in which I wouldn't say black Europeans were central, but certainly integral.
Hearing you talk, it makes me think that actually, you know, I'm white, obviously, but I do think it's time, long overdue, that actually, you know, white society began to, you know, own this agenda and really kind of, if you're talking the we society, you know, it's got to be kind of completely ethnically and colorblind. It's got to be wholly inclusive, and we've got to kind of really.
I mean, I feel that there's a way in which we can, and this works for all kinds of identities, really. Say, oh, this is our story. And our story is bigger than we imagined, and it's more, you know, exciting. And we didn't know. There's a wonderful line in Andrea Levy's Small Island, where Gilbert, the central character, Gilbert, who's Jamaican, he's in the military, and he just says, how comes England did not know me? He said, I could have told you where England was. You know, if you gave me a map, I would be able to tell you. But I meet these people, they have no idea who I am or where I'm from. How can that be? And there is this sense of kind of marginality that, you know, England would benefit from English people, white people, all of us would benefit from understanding our story in a much more complete way. And it's the mistake that I think is often made, that people think that when you talk about black history or white history or colonial history, that well, it's just going to make us feel bad. And it's like, well, it needn't. It might make you feel whole. It might make you feel, you know, there's a range of ways in which it might make you feel, you know, that it might make you feel better. Of course, there are bad things about it, but it would be a weird history when there weren't. But there's also awesome things about it. And here we are. It explains how we got here. So it would be very difficult to know where we're going to go next without understanding how we got to where we are.
Gary, thank you very much for a fantastic conversation. We've covered some ground here. We've explored identity politics, its roots. We've tried to kind of get some notion of where it's all sprung from. Is it economic disadvantage? Is there something else going on? We've tried to kind of open up, above all, I mean, your kind of, I suppose your big message is, and you summed it up well just there, is that it's got to be values that trump the noxiousness of identity politics. Otherwise, it ends up with a very, inverted commas, bad we. Yeah. And if you're trying to promote a we society that actually has strands of communitarianism, strands of looking out after each other's backs, some sense of mutual respect, and some sense of the institutional roots of that, there's got to be a powerful sense of values. It's been a fascinating kind of exchange. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Will.
Thank you for listening to the We Society from the Academy of Social Sciences. I'm Will Hutton. And to be the first to find out about future episodes, future podcasts, please subscribe in the usual ways. And why not leave us a review as well? So to find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences, head to acss.org.uk or follow us on Twitter. Until next time, goodbye. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences, acss.org.uk. I'm Will Hutton. The producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production.